So we're on to week seven of a 10-week course. So last week, you know, when I say, oh, next week we're going to talk about demystifying death, usually I don't say what the topic is for the coming week, because if I say we're going to talk about demystifying death, a whole lot of people don't come. And as we can see, it's a much smaller class tonight. And as I was saying it, I should have said, oh, I can't quite remember what we're going to talk about next week, which is usually what I do. But, it really shows how we do need to demystify death, isn't it? Because it's such a taboo subject. It's it's an uncomfortable subject. There's a lot of fear and superstition around it. And so that's so important to be able to start the conversation and to start feeling comfortable about it. So what we've already covered, what's led us up to this particular topic, you know, we've been looking at what Buddhism is, becoming an inner being, looking within rather than kind of being a materialist looking without. We've looked at the nature of our mind, the continuity of our consciousness, and how it doesn't just come into existence with our birth, just like all the atoms that make up our body don't come into existence with our birth. The atoms come from somewhere and there's a continuity, a physical continuum. And the mind also, there is a mental continuum from life to life. And so then last week we looked at karma. So what continues with the mind are all of the imprints of what we do, what we say, how we communicate, all of our habits. It's like putting whatever we do, put in upstream, and then downstream from life to life we experience the results. So then this week we're going to have a look at, well, what actually happens at the death process, what happens to the mind at the time of death, and how we can think about our own mortality so that it's useful, so that we don't just freeze, or so we don't go into denial, or so we don't just panic and become totally hedonistic. Like, how do we actually constructively think about death so that it can benefit us, motivate us instead of paralyze us? We're also going to have a look at what happens in the dying process, because this is something that from a Tibetan Buddhist tradition is very, it's very subtle, and there's an incredible lineage of knowledge about this. And in our culture, there isn't that much knowledge about it. We've got a whole lot of knowledge about birth and what happens at, you know, when people are born, but nothing about the death process. So we'll have a look at actually what happens, and then a little section at the end about, well, how we can prepare for, hey, hello, come in, how we can prepare for our own death and what to do with a dead Buddhist. So, something really practical. And I mean, one of the reasons why this class is so important, I just realized I haven't actually turned my microphone on, though nobody noticed, right? why this topic is so important is that many times we'll have a slip of the tongue and we'll say, oh, you know, if I die, I want to be buried in such and such cemetery, or if I die, I hope so-and-so gets the family jewels. And it's always this word, if, comes out, if I die. Well, of course we know it's going to happen, but just in the way that we talk about it, the little slip of the tongue is quite revealing. So let's take a moment to set our motivation. And in the karma class, we kind of realized how important it is to have a really good motivation, and then at the end dedicate, and that then it becomes a very powerful and positive activity that we do. So powerful, in fact, that it becomes a positive seed that can throw us into fortunate rebirths in the future, because it's a complete activity. And the wonderful thing about setting our motivation is that we can adjust our motivation to make it the very best possible one. So let's just get physically settled. The two-point posture to have a straight spine and then a relaxed body. So to make sure that the spine is straight, imagine a fine thread of light running up through the base of your, from the base of your spine up through your body, just in front of the spine and coming out the crown of your head. Feel how your posture naturally adjusts to become slightly straighter, more alert. And once the spine is straight, then let your shoulders relax, let your shoulders drop and release any tension from the neck and the shoulders. Head slightly tilted forward, chin pulled back, relaxed jaw, slight smile on the lips, tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. Eyes lightly closed. Forehead relaxed. Just letting the body breathe itself. Becoming present in the room. Letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. Anything that's really important will be there at the end of the class, so we can just put them aside. Just being happy to be here. Letting all of the busyness and the thoughts of the day begin to settle down, like autumn leaves coming to rest once the wind has stopped. And bringing to mind the main reason that brought you here tonight. Whatever the immediate purpose or the immediate reason is. And then we can extend our motivation to something really vast, long term, without putting any limits on our purpose here. We all have an instinctual wish to have happiness, to not have any problems. We also have a wish to make our life meaningful, to make our life count. And we want to benefit ourselves, we want to benefit our loved ones, bring them happiness, not problems. So we can extend our motivation to think all living beings, they're just like us in this instinctual yearning for happiness and peace and meaning. All living beings, just like us, suffer. So our motivation tonight can be not just for our immediate benefit or those closest to us, but to really take the essence of our life, to bring the ultimate meaning to our life, to be able to live a good life and to be able to face our own death without fear, without regret, but use it on the path to enlightenment for ourselves and for all living beings. And along the way of this really vast motivation, we can think we're doing this class tonight so that we can be helpful to ourselves, to others, to our loved ones, to our pets, not only in their life, but also at their time of death. So with this motivation, gently bring your focus back to the room. And so demystifying death. And why do we even have to think about death now? Well, one of the things is it makes our life meaningful now in terms of it's not being morbid, but it's putting our life into perspective that we're not going to live forever. And once we kind of realize that, then what we spend our time doing changes. So many times when I read about people who've had a near-death experience, it changes people's lives, doesn't it? And it changes because our attitude changes. And now suddenly, you know, going to work and making pots of money is not the main thing. Generally what people say is spending time with the family. That's what I've got to do more of. Or they have a bucket list, or they've shuffled some things up to the top of the bucket list and just released the other things. So that really shows that how we live our life is a little disjointed. We usually live our life with this attitude that we'll live forever. So we have a much better chance of making our life really meaningful and beneficial and not wasting it. We can also die without regret. So many people get towards the end of their life and have really deep regrets. And there is that wonderful thing that's been going around Facebook for years about the top five regrets of dying people, you know, from the palliative care nurse. And so one of the main regrets was to not having lived an authentic life, to having lived, say, a life trying to please others, or keep your identity in the closet, becoming a banker when you wanted to be an artist, or, you know, and then trying everything to please others and not being authentic to oneself. And so then you get to towards the end of your life and you get a terminal prognosis. You've got X amount of months to live or something, and then it's suddenly quick, change everything. So rather than having that all come, regrets and resentments at the end of our life, it's much better to think about that now so that later on we can have a peaceful mind, we can die without fear. And also if we can find out what happens during death time and how to be prepared, then we can stop being terrified, because a lot of the terror comes from uncertainty. So, yes, intellectually we know we're going to die, but we haven't realised it yet. In fact, I remember being in the pub one night with a guy that said, no, I've decided I'm not going to die. Young male, but serious. I think, oh, okay. So the thing is that at the moment it's worth thinking about our mortality. It's worth meditating on death, contemplating it, and actually letting ourselves feel some fear or anxiety. That's actually a good thing, because it will get our life back into harmony with what our values are. Because if we feel a bit uncomfortable about thinking about death, it already shows that we're out of step. So it's kind of our discomfort about this topic shows that there's more work that we need to do. It's like a really good wake-up call. And didn't COVID do this for us? It really showed us that what we spend a lot of our time doing isn't what matters to us a whole lot. So it's worth having the courage to have the fear now, not later on. We don't want to have the fear when we're actually going through the death process, so that later on when we are dying, our mind is at peace. We have whatever refuge that we have. We have confidence. It can be a joyous thing. It can be a meaningful experience to those around us, and we have a calm mind. So Gelug Rinpoche, this great book called Good Life, Good Death. And let me find the page. So he says, just this is just a little paragraph on impermanence. And he says, we all have this idea, I won't die today. Everybody thinks like that, including people on their deathbed. We visit someone at the hospital. We all know they're dying. They know it too. But still, they talk about what they'll do next week. It's important to remember that. Why is it important? Because our troubles come unexpectedly, particularly death. You go see a doctor and the doctor says you're fine. You get into the car and then you have a car crash and die. It can happen. This is to remind people that this life is wonderful, but there are limitations. Before those limitations take over, achieve what you want to achieve. Do something while you're able to. Right now, everything is wonderful and happy, beautiful, enjoyable, but that well-being is temporary. It could change any minute. Anything can go wrong at any moment. So this talk of death or impermanence is not meant to make you afraid. The whole purpose of it is for you to have compassion for yourself and to travel well. So I so many times here at Lungri Tampa Centre, even with Buddhist people that have been coming to class for years and years and years, inevitably each year there's a couple of people that die and it's always a surprise. Or there's a couple of people that are in hospital that are palliative or whatever, and it's like trying to organise to go and see them. It's like, oh, I don't have time this week. We'll go next week. Still happens, even with people who've studied, because it's so ingrained in us to be grasping at permanence. And I remember one of our students saying he was talking to Eddie about his mate that was in hospital and is thinking, oh, I better go and see him. And, you know, time was ticking on today, so maybe you'll go tomorrow. And Eddie had said, go today. So he made the effort to rush through peak hour and went today. And they had a great time, good old chinwag, really happy. He went home and his mate died that night. So that happens over and over again. It's really important. If there's a choice, today or tomorrow, it's like, do it today. So there is a really constructive way of how to think about death. It's called the 9-point death contemplation, and it's a structured way so that when we think about it, we get a conclusion that motivates us, that propels us in the right direction. Because I know when I think about death, often I just panic and I go either, oh, well, if I'm going to die tomorrow, if I don't know if I'm going to die tomorrow or not, I'm just going to do whatever I want today and hang the consequences. It's a pretty ridiculous response, but, you know, that's a little bit of that comes up. Or I just think, oh, well, then I can't do anything, and I freeze. I go completely blank. So we want to have this contemplation about death so that it brings things into perspective, realistic perspective for us, and is helpful. So the first thing is to think about, okay, so death is certain, and we can just ask ourselves a question. Has anyone been able to stop death? Has anyone tried? Yeah. So what are all the ways people have tried to overcome death or stop death?
Cryogenics
comes to mind immediately. Yep, that's right. Yes, Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail. A whole lot of movies come to mind. A whole lot of vampire movies come to mind. You know, the Egyptians, all that kind of thing. There's a whole lot of people putting money into various stem cell research to try and turn off the aging gene and all these kinds of things. So far, though, no one's been able to actually stop death. Even people have asked me, well, you know, how come the Buddha died? So actually, the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, born as a human being, who went through this amazing process of investigation and meditation and thinking and analysis and developing his mind and actually became enlightened. But this relative body, it's impermanent, comes into existence, goes. So the body, you can't say the Buddha died, but the body passed away from, the Buddha passed away from this life. So even the wealthy, the powerful, doesn't matter, they can't bribe death. You know, even when the wealthy die, it makes the news. But it makes the news because we think, oh, you know, how could they die? Or I remember when David Bowie died, you know, it's like, oh, did you know David Bowie died? Like, it's a shock. How could he? You can't add to the lifespan. So we can't kind of keep on extending. Even the scientists are saying, even if we could turn off the aging gene or do whatever, the most that we could extend the lifespan to is about 120 years. It's not like that we can make it 200, 300, 400 years because of the physical basis. So we can't add to the lifespan. In fact, it's getting shorter all the time. So from a Buddha's point of view, from the moment of conception, from that moment, we're speeding towards death. And we'll die even if we're in the middle of something. So that's the one that gets me, that we'll, even if we're not ready. So when we're thinking about the inevitability of death, that death is certain, the point that we should come to, or the conclusion that we come to, is therefore, instead of just being a materialist, instead of just living for this life only, just living it up, because this life will come to an end, and that's for sure, then we've got to follow a spiritual path, something that's meaningful. Because if we're on a materialistic path, it doesn't really matter. This body ends and that's the end of it. But if we're thinking that there's something that happens after death, the continuum of consciousness cannot be cut, doesn't come to an end. Consciousness is just, you know, continues on. Then what we do matters. So we've got to do something more than just for this materialistic life. So the conclusion is, I must follow a spiritual path. Then we have the next contemplation, which is, well, yep, our death's certain, okie dokie, but the time of death, has any doctor been able to give a prediction? When you go to the doctor and they say, you know, you've got a terminal illness or whatever, and you go, well, doc, how long do I have? And they do not want to tell you, because even the experts don't know. They might say, oh, you've got, you know, 3 months to a year, or, and then how many times do people prove them wrong? Or how many times does it happen much quicker? So just last week, one of our members went into hospital for heart surgery, had successful heart surgery, came home, was okay for about a week, and staying at her grown-up daughter's house. And her daughter, who's also a member here, went in to check on her in the morning, and she died that night. So it's unpredictable. We don't, the lifespan, it's not fixed. It's not like we have this amount of days and we know how many they are. It's also unpredictable because actually there are there's more chances of dying than living, and the human body is fragile. So even all the things that support life, like food and sunshine and water, those things can also kill us. Skin cancer, poisoned water, food that has no nutrients. The people that we live with, our relationships, they're also the ones that kill us. So the time is unknown. It's an unknown quantity. So the conclusion for that one is, because we don't know when we're going to die, we've got to follow the Dharma, or a spiritual path, from now on. Not when we retire, not when we, oh yeah, I'm going to do a retreat next year, or it's sometime in the future, but from now. Get a wriggle on. And the third part is that it will only at, only Dharma can help at the time of death. So what this means is that we can't really take anything with us when we die. You know, there's a Scottish saying, a shroud has no pockets. So we spend all that time amassing money, worrying about it, trying to, you know, get a house or security or whatever, and then on your deathbed, you can't take it with you. And then not only that, but you've got the worry of who's going to get it. So whatever we've accumulated throughout our life actually can't help us at the end of our life. We can't take it with us. In fact, there's another saying, the only things that we can take with us is what we've given away. Our kind of spirit of generosity is what we can take with us. The joy that we get from giving things away and benefiting others, or seeing the joy in someone's face of having those things, that's what we take with us. Not the stuff. The stuff actually just creates so much more distress and anxiety. So whether we're rich or poor, whether we're a millionaire, whether we're hopeless, homeless, our wealth at the time of death doesn't make any difference. Also, our friends and relatives, even if they want to help us, can't go through it for us. And often friends and relatives can be freaking out, and many people who've been to a funeral or been around someone who's dying, you know that it can bring out the worst in the family members as well as the best. But family members can end up acting really erratic and really rude and having outrageous arguments when normally it's been quite nice. But all of the stress can actually bring out the worst in people. So friends and relatives may not be able to help, and our body cannot help us either. Actually, in the process of separating from our body starts, it feels like turning against us, betraying us. It's not working anymore. It's like this epic battle of trying to keep it working, but it's not. So the conclusion for this one, because only Dharma, only our spiritual practice, what we have within, can help us, not our body, not our wealth, not our friends, then we've got to make sure that the path that we follow is a Dharma path or a spiritual path. That's our main path. So therefore, I must follow only the Dharma, or mainly the Dharma. There's nothing else that'll help. Everything else may actually become a hindrance. So if we have this 9 points, so it's the 3 main points, and then there's some sub-points within them. If we keep those in mind, it puts our life into perspective. So it means that we won't get distracted. We won't spend our time just kind of being belligerent or resentful. We will naturally be able to make the most of our life. So actually, thinking about death like this, we can end up feeling really lucky, really fortunate, because we start recognizing what we have despite it all. We won't waste our life. We won't be fearful. We won't be disappointed in our life. Because we've got it in this kind of perspective. So what questions or comments do you have about this? Yes, yeah. So they say at the time of conception is where the mind enters into the beginnings of that body. So the mind and the physical come together at the time of conception. But, of course, because it's only a few cells, then the experience or the expression of that mind is very, not necessarily basic, but subtle. And then as the fetus grows and the senses, you know, the ears grow and the heart grows and all of that, then the sense consciousnesses also develop. And so the consciousness becomes more complex. But, yeah, from the time of conception. So actually I think it's even like there's conception, and then from the second moment on, it's aging. Oh, yeah, that's right. So fear of a prolonged illness or a prolonged death, dementia. Yeah, so that Thinking of death as a release, yeah, so there's a lot of fear of pain as well. So that, but also I think that might be also because there is an assumption that there's no benefit or nothing that you can do, no way that you can benefit yourself or others. But really from a Buddhist point of view, you can even benefit if you're in a coma. So a lot of this death contemplation shows us how comfortable we are with our own mind, with our own experience. And lockdown showed us that too, didn't it? How comfortable are we with me, myself, and I, you know, and many of us are not. And so the thought of aging and not being able to communicate is fearful instead of, wow, what a fantastic, peaceful opportunity. So that consternation of may actually point out some other underlying things. There's always something that we can do. So in the next class, actually, when we talk about bodhicitta, with the bodhicitta motivation, we can go through anything, even dementia, and still be able to benefit ourselves and others. But if we're just thinking that we're just this body and what we can go out and do physically, then of course it's terrifying. But that's kind of like a materialist view. Either way, what we have to fall back on is our inner strength, isn't it? Even in colloquial terms, we'd say our resilience. Even if we're not thinking of a spiritual path, it's still our inner resilience that we have and our attitude. That's what we have to fall back on. And so from this point of view, only Dharma can help at the time of death. That's what it means. Our virtues, our qualities, our realizations, our attitudes, all of that inner life is what helps us. Assisted dying or euthanasia. So there's a couple of things. So one is that there are two aspects that are lumped under the one thing. So one is where someone is on the machines being kept alive. And so if you turn the machines off, they will go through a natural death. The other is when someone is alive and you put an end to their life. And they're quite different situations. So there's assumptions under that of wanting to put an end to your life. There's an assumption there that what comes next will be better. And there's an assumption that what's happening now is useless or not worth it. So that's the questions that we've got to start looking at. Because as we know, human beings will go through anything if they think it's worth it. Happily go through anything. You know, so what people go through to save their family or to save their country, when there's a purpose for it, will happily go through a huge amount of difficulty for it. So that's the actual question in there. Okay, so let's have a look what death is. Before we can talk about death, we've got to figure out, well, what is it? What is death exactly? You'd think this would be a no-brainer, but actually it's a progressive loss of physical, sensory, and mental functions as our body closes down. So as our the body starts closing down, the nervous system starts closing down. So from the most obvious to the more and more subtle. And it's a progression. It's not like you're alive, 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 and then dead. It's a spectrum or a process. There's an arbitrary line that's drawn, and where that line is drawn depends on our circumstances. It depends whether we're in a big hospital or whether we're out in the bush. So the line is drawn on a spectrum from when the breath ceases, the brain death, when the heart stops, the nervous system, circulatory system, all of those, depending on our circumstances, is when we'll say death has happened. And actually, legally, death, you're certified that dead when the doctors can do no more. It's not when something or other happens, but when they can no longer do anything to help you stay alive. So if you're in a hospital, they've got all the paddles to, you know, and the machines and everything. There's a huge amount that that doctors can do to try and keep you alive. But if you're in the bush and you have a car accident and there isn't any of those things, where you'd say that someone's died and where you can do no more is quite different. Does anyone here watch Bondi Rescue? So it's one of these shows. I love that show. I'm mesmerised by it because right there's this whole thing that if there are lifesavers there, then your heart can stop, your breathing can stop, but you're not certified dead then because they can bring you back. But if there was no lifesavers there, no lifeguard there, then death happens. So, again, it's this kind of this line that it depends. And of course, once the breath has stopped, once the heart has stopped, brain death then happens how many minutes later after that? So again, it's a spectrum. And there's been some cases of little kids that have fallen into an icy lake and been pulled out a couple of hours later. And something about the child's metabolism and being, you know, quick frozen, basically they were able to revive. So even then, there's this spectrum depending on the circumstances. And then the circuitry system actually takes 2 to 3 days to stop. Even on a physical level, there's this progression. From a Buddhist point of view, it's very simple. It's when body and mind separate. But the mind doesn't separate from the body when the breath stops, doesn't separate from the body when the heart stops, doesn't separate from the body when there's brain death, doesn't separate from the body when the nervous system stops. It's later on. So just like there's that progression, a spectrum there, when the mind separates from the body is a little after that. So we'll go into that in a moment. The example that I like to give, it's just like in childbirth, you know, the death process is a universal phenomena, yet each death is unique. So just like with childbirth, you know, the baby comes out, but mothers will have very different experiences. And you can go to however many planning classes beforehand. Has anyone had children and gone to planning classes and did it prepare you for what happened? No. But what would happen if you didn't know, if you didn't prepare? Like, you know, there's teenagers that grow up with no sex education and they go to the toilet, they think they're dying of cancer, but actually just they're giving birth. It's the first that they knew they were pregnant. This happens in the modern day with people with no sex education. So even though you might think, oh, reading all the books and doing all the preparation didn't help, it's certainly better to know than not even know what's going on. Yeah, when we look at what about the death process, we're like those teenage girls that don't even know they're pregnant. We have no idea what happens. We don't get to see any human beings die because they're whipped away to hospital or away from us in an old people's home. We rarely get to see our pets die. You know, we're completely shielded from it. So there's this mystery and then a whole lot of fear there. And we're not familiar. We can't even recognize that it's happening. So the whole purpose of being able to understand or to demystify death is to become familiar with it. So at least we're a little bit prepared. We know who to ask to come with us, to be with us, to help us. Okay, so navigating the death process. So this is like having a map of what's going to happen to us. And it's good to become familiar with the map. So all of you are here in Lungri Tumpa Centre at the moment, and when you first came to Lungri Tumpa Centre, you probably looked at a map of how to get from your house to here. And so as you were going along, you'd recognise the various landmarks and you went, oh, yeah, I'm going in the right direction. And then, you know, you see the whatever bits and pieces and you go, oh, there it is. So there's a lot of comfort in having a map and being able to plot, oh, yep, I'm going along on the right, in the right direction, that we can navigate our way with confidence. So what happens during the process of dying are, from the point of view of us who say who's dying, these four what are called visions or four experiences, because they're not visual, but they're overall experiences. And these first four, there's eight stages, and these first four can happen off and on over a few days and then over a few hours of the death process. So just like when someone's pregnant, they might have some contractions a few days beforehand. It's not happening straight away, and then they know, okay, it's on now. So the same thing with these first four visions. There may be a little inkling for the first over the first few months or few days, and then over a space of hours we go through these steps, which I'll go through in a moment. And then after the fourth vision, the breathing stops and we lose consciousness. But that's not what we'd say is, okay, death is finished. That's halfway through. And if you manage to have a leisurely death, dying at home or dying in a hospice or something, where you're able to go through the natural process, then the breathing stops. But if you're there in the presence of someone whose breathing stopped, you can tell they're still there. It's just that the breathing has stopped. You can tell there's a presence there. And that's because the mind hasn't left the body yet. Also, when people have been, say, called to the morgue to identify they're the next of kin, and you know, they're asked, is this your husband or is this your daughter? And they said, no, that's not my husband. That's the shell of my husband. You know, that's the body of my husband, but my husband's not there. So it's very clear when the mind has left the body that now that is a body, that's an empty shell. So what happens in this time when the breathing has stopped but the consciousness hasn't left the body yet are these subtle experiences. So they're called white appearance, red increase, black near attainment, and the clear light of death. And they are experiences that happen on a subtle level. So it's almost like a pre-verbal level or a post-verbal level, because we no longer have conceptions, we no longer have language, we no longer have feeling in our body. It's a very overarching experience. This is from Gelug Rinpoche again. So how does life work? The physical body is given by the genetic material that comes from our parents to ourselves and is then transmitted to our children. The physical body is a borrowed apartment that we happen to be staying in. The body is made up of four elements: earth, water, fire, air. All the fluid in your body is the water element. The heat that aids in processes such as digestion is the fire element. Breathing and circulation are the air element. The flesh and bones and nerves are the earth element. So when these four elements are balanced, we don't have any aches or pains. We call ourselves well. When they're off balance and one element becomes weaker than the others, we feel discomfort or pain in our physical bodies, and it may also affect our mind. Death is separation or disconnecting, and at the time of dying, which may last weeks or even months, these four elements actually dissolve one into another or become weaker and fall away. So four kind of aspects. Now, how we know about this is because of the, you know, centuries-long tradition of meditators being able to, in meditation, access what happens as the coarse consciousnesses and then the subtle ones fall away at death time, of also the meditators being able to recognize what's happening with the person who's, say, dying in front of them, and also memories from past life and past death. So this very long tradition, and also very sophisticated tradition of understanding what goes on. Just like we have a sophisticated tradition with microscopes and telescopes and all sorts of things, This is of using the internal technology. So let's have a look at what these visions are. So the first one, the Mirage vision. So this is, you might have seen maybe in Melbourne, you know, in the gallery, they've got the water coming down the glass. So that kind of shimmery effect, that everything starts to have this shimmery effect. So my mother, Inta, when she was dying, she said she had that, she'd had dreams like this for maybe a year before she died, as well as having this things actually becoming shimmery. And so in the actual death process, when that starts to happen, your limbs become weak, the vision becomes a bit blurred, becomes difficult to move the eyes. In the movies, you know, that's the death scene where people's eyes roll in the back of their head. So that's the beginning of this. But from the internal experience, what's happening is this shimmery effect. And the body becomes heavy. So we get a little experience of this when we go to sleep. The body becomes heavy. And that's because the coarse physical consciousness absorbs so that we can sleep. So that if we're even dreaming about running around, we're not actually running around. It's just in the mind because the physical one has subsided. Then the next is this internal experience of smoke, an inner vision like a smoke-filled room. And we have a loss of feelings. So we actually no longer notice the difference between pleasure, pleasant or unpleasant. Between pain or pleasant. So in the death process, it's quite counterintuitive in a way because those kind of experiences are falling away from the person who's dying. But from the point of view of if you're there watching somebody die, death is a messy process. So it looks really dramatic. It looks like there's this epic battle of trying to, you know, stay alive. But actually what's happening from the point of view of the person dying is things are falling away. So you can take heart from that. Then, so the person's still, you know, conscious and possibly even still talking. Then there's a vision of fireflies, little pings of light like this. And what happens is the ability to be able to distinguish between who's who falls away. So this people often say, you might go and visit someone who's dying and they call you your sister's name or your mother's name. And you go, no, I'm Miffy, or, you know, I'm Martin or I'm Stephen. But actually what's happening is that distinguishing between this and that falls away. So you mightn't be able to remember the names of friends or relatives. So things become much, much more basic. So it's probably more just like living being rather than this person or that person. All of those distinguishing things just fall away. So for that, if the dying person can't remember who you are, don't take it personally. It's not that they've forgotten you. It's that all of those distinctions that we make such a big deal about in our life are lessening. They're just falling away. And also that's when the hands and feet start to get really cold. And it's often when the breathing starts changing as well, where the in-breath is weak, the out-breath is much stronger. So when my mother was dying, she sounded like Darth Vader. I used to be able to mimic exactly how it sounded, the death rattle. Oh, my God, I had no idea it was like that. It's quite something. So, again, from a point of view of watching this happen, it can be quite dramatic. But from the point of view of the person dying, all of these things are falling away. Then there's the flickering flame. So it's not actually that we see the flame, but the flicker of the reflection of the flame there. So they often say like a reflection of firelight on a cave. So an experience like that, and that's where you can't move around anymore. You've lost all kind of sense of touch or taste or smell. They say that's when you, when the work of this life is forgotten. So you've completely released what all of the busyness that we have of this life. And this is where the breathing stops. And then normally when the breathing stops, we'll just think, oh, they're dead. But actually, it's like the battle to breathe has stopped, but the person's still there. There's still a process going on. So when my mother was dying, I wondered, would I be able to tell when the consciousness left? And my main worry was, what if I got it wrong? What if I couldn't tell? But what I found is it's a no-brainer. You can tell there's a person there still or not. That's something that we can clearly see. And it's the same I've seen with my pets too, with my cats. I've seen that's a dead cat. It's not like, oh, maybe they're still alive. It's like clearly no consciousness there anymore. But while the consciousness is there, generally it can be, between 2 to 3 days that the consciousness can stay there connected with the body. So it depends on what kind of illness you have that you're dying of. If the body's really racked with illness, this whole process may happen much quicker. With my mother, it was about 2.5 days before the consciousness left. And you could tell that the consciousness, you know, her hands got cold, but like the top part of her arms was still warm. It was like the warmth retreated from the limbs to the heart area that stayed warm for like up to 2.5 days. So what's happening then is a whole different process. So the white vision or the white appearance, like a clear, empty sky filled with the light of the moon. So again, it's not a vision with the eyes because the whole, you know, all of that stopped working. It's an experience. It's an inner experience that's beyond words, beyond concepts. So now the internal system begins to dissolve. By this time, the body's dead, but the consciousness may remain because the internal separation has not yet happened. So then red increase, the inner vision, like a clear, empty sky filled with the rays of a red sunset. Then black near attainment, a vision of total darkness, empty of any form, and it ends in a momentary complete loss of consciousness. So it's like all the most subtle consciousnesses have dissolved. And then the clear light of death. So I tried to find an image that represents clear light, and the closest that we can think of is the light at dawn. You know how it's pristine and so clear you could almost touch it. So there's something about that light. So this is the most subtle consciousness. It's the final vision or experience at the death time. And if you're able to have a natural death, you might be able to be in this clear light of death for a while. Might be a day, might be a couple of days. And actually, the great meditators can stay in this clear light of death for 10 days, 2 weeks. And because the consciousness has not left the body doesn't rot, doesn't decay, because death hasn't actually happened yet. But this clear light of death is very subtle. It's like it's such a subtle thing that if our mind is just propelling all the way through this process, propelled by karma, fears, worries, preoccupations or whatever, it's like blink and you'll miss it. You'll go straight on through and into the intermediate state and then into the next rebirth. So all of the meditations that we do to still the mind, they have a really big purpose here, that we get used to becoming still and aware, to becoming clear and aware, so that when we have this ultimate experience of clarity, we can stay there without jumping around all over the place. So is Holiness the Dalai Lama, in this book, The Foundation of Buddhist Practice, just has a little bit to say about that. So the subtlest mind, the fundamental, innate, clear light mind manifests. This is the actual moment of death, although the subtlest wind mind is still present in the body. And a well-trained practitioner will meditate on emptiness, the nature of reality. There is no rigor mortis, and there might be a slight sense of heat if we hold our hand above the person's heart chakra at the center of their chest. During this time, the relationship between the body and the mind has not been severed, and the body does not decay. It's better to avoid touching or moving the body at this time. So, questions? Yes. No, so all of those, that sense of identity is completely gone. That goes with those first four visions. Who's who, those arbitrary distinctions, completely finished. And, of course, because this is the subtle mind, so you can't feel anything in your body, but the mind is still connected with the body, but all of those what are called coarse consciousnesses can't distract us anymore. So it's like sometimes I hear about people going off and spending time in a float tank. Has anyone done that? Yeah, right. So, you know, you have all of the sensory things go, and then what happens? What's the experience? You fall asleep. Hopefully you don't drown, right? But, I mean, when the distractions go, what can happen is the mind becomes very clear. And, in fact, what will happen in a float tank is that your sensory consciousness will throw up hallucinations, because when there's no external things coming out, then you know, the mind fills it up, fills that vacuum up. So our intermediate state is a little bit like that. We're born into the intermediate state, the bardo, and the mind throws up all of these things that have been what is, you know, there in our preoccupations and our current state of emotional, you know, emotional state, our karmic state, all of that comes up. So in the death process is this amazing time where we have no distractions, so we don't have to get up and go to the loo. We have no sounds distracting us. We have no relatives distracting us. No momentary things about this life distracting us. We're completely free of distractions, all the way to even subtle ones to do, you know, with our nervous system, anything like that. So it's the perfect time to meditate. But the only reason we'd want to meditate is because that's what we've been practicing. That's what we want to do. And what do we meditate on? The wisdom realizing emptiness, the wisdom understanding dependent arising and emptiness. And that meditation can be incredibly powerful because there are no distractions. And so the, you know, a good Buddhist should be able to go through this and actually spend time meditating, purifying obscurations, developing realizations, having a huge amount of progress happen. You know, we've heard of lamas that have passed away in the meditation posture. Their breathing has stopped. They've been in the meditation posture, but their body's still fresh. The attendants come in and they check. Body's still there, still fresh. And it can be up to, you know, 10 days, 13, 14 days. Then one day the attendants will come in and the body's fallen over and it's grey, it's not fresh anymore. Consciousness is left. So they'll say, you know, so-and-so, Geshe so-and-so has finished his meditation now, because that's what he's been doing, meditating in this incredible refined state. And then finish the meditation and off to probably the next life, propelled by compassion instead of karma and delusion, to continue.
So base your understanding of death on the idea of a lonely cave. And I don't understand how, like, what that metaphor represents. Like, is it a lonely cave in the sense that no one understands what you're going through? Like, no one can experience what you're going through. So the idea is to generate compassion.
I'm not sure what the metaphor of see your death as a lonely cave is, but I mean, one thing is that loneliness, like that's a subjective thing, isn't it? And so loneliness kind of comes from a whole lot of mistaken points of view to think that we are alone, for one, where we're actually with all sentient beings. But the experience of loneliness comes because we grasp at ourselves. So the result is a feeling of loneliness. So if we don't have that grasping at ourselves and we think about the benefit of others, we'll never feel lonely. And then, of course, everything that we go through, we have to go through it. No one else can go through it for us. Even though, say, you know, parents would go through anything. They would go through their child's suffering for them or their child's illness for them, but they can't. So for that, we have to go through it by ourselves. No one can come along with us, even if they wanted to. But from an altruistic point of view, we can do that for others too. We can go through the experience so that our friends and relatives don't have to freak out. You know, we can help them. And many children do that, help their parents through, you know, if a child is dying or something, they try and help their parents not be sad. So we can also, if our heart is propelled by compassion, then when we go through the death process, we're not going to be freaking out. We're going to be able to meditate in this. No, normally if you have a sudden death, then you go through this entire experience of the eight stages of the death process, but very fast. And also it depends on like how racked the body is with disease, whether it happens very quickly or not. Some people's the consciousness can leave very quickly after the breath stops because everything kind of collapses down. But other times in an ordinary death, you may not be able to still the mind into this experience, but just go on through it. And it's just there for a few seconds.
Is that clear light that some people say after they have a near-death experience?
Like the light at the end of the tunnel?
Or is that
no.
The earlier light that you mentioned?
The light at the end of the tunnel is more like the white vision.
The white vision, yeah.
And so I think once you get into those visions, then there's no way back. But with the other ones, it depends.
And it's so subtle that you'd have to have a very still mind to observe it.
Yeah, to be able to be aware of it and not be just pushed around how we normally are by our experiences. So preparing for our own death, having the courage to contemplate death and impermanence now, there are many practices that we can do before death to prepare. Once we're in the dying process, it's like me. It's like I've always thought, oh, if I go overseas, I'll learn the language on the plane on the way over. Can't be done. It's better to start preparing now. And there are many practices. And when my mother was given a terminal diagnosis, you know, 3 months to live or something, and she wrote to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and Rinpoche wrote back this amazing letter that started, how terrible and how wonderful that you've got this diagnosis. And it's terrible, of course, but it's wonderful because now you've got three months of a window of opportunity to get everything in order. It's like, actually, it's really lucky to know, my end is approaching now. So what are the things that really matter here? What are the practices to do? Who do I have to say sorry to? Give all your stuff away now rather than have everyone fight about it afterwards when you die. So actually that part is wonderful. Whereas the unexpected death, that's the real shocker. So how terrible and how wonderful. One of the things that we can do just to get started, write a will. So hands up here if you have a will, hands up. Hall of shame, hands up if you don't have a will. Okie dokie, that's your homework. So you can go to the public trustee, they'll do a will for you for free. It's great. And I got to admit, it took me about 3 years of being at Lungri Tumba Centre before I got it together to, because, you know, there's just denial happening in there, isn't there? But then I thought, this is something you don't want to visit on your family. They don't want to have to be thinking about technical legal stuff when you've just died. You don't want to put them through it. So writing a will also, because you get to think about who's going to get what, you start practicing releasing your stuff, imagining someone getting your precious things, giving it away. And that's a very good thing to do now, to start releasing our attachment. Have the conversation with your family. Talk to your family about what you want to have happen. So one of the most important things is that if we get to have a leisurely death at home, if we get to die at home or in our sleep or even in a hospice, to not have people fuss, to not have people, you know, grab the body and move it around and do all sorts of things, but to actually be able to be calm. What you want to have happen. Not only that, but if you are palliative or you're dying or you've had an unfortunate accident, that your family know, for instance, to call Lungri Tumba Centre, what you want to have happen, at least so that we can say prayers, if nothing else. So there are the two conversations, aren't there? There's the birds and the bees conversation, and then there's this one. And you want to talk about it now because it's just way too confronting when the actual thing happens. It's also worth getting together an advanced health directive that spells out whether you want to be an organ donor, whether what kind of, you know, what you want to have happen with your body. When do you want the machines turned off or not? Who do you want to make that decision? It's really, it's a good process to go through to develop an advanced health directive, because it actually makes our mortality more real, because we have to start thinking about the specifics, but it's so helpful for the relatives. It's so unbelievably helpful. And I've had close friends die without an advanced health directive, and it's really, really messy because people don't agree in families what they want to have happen. You can organise to have one of our amazing nuns or a Dharma friend with you when you're dying. And that can be very helpful for the family too, because often the family can be terrified about what's going on and not know what to do. So part of what our job here at Lungri Tumba Centre is to be here for the life and death situations, and to call us when you're dying, when a family member of yours is dying, even when your pet is dying, because that's what we're here for. So actually, I can give this out to you now. Bruce, would you do the honours and hand these out for me? There's this little card that you'll be good if you can have two each, I'd say. So you can have one on the fridge and one in your wallet. And I'll go through what's on it in a moment. But what's on it is my phone number, because I don't want you texting me saying about, you know, what's on Facebook or should I come to class or whatever, but I do want you calling me at 3 a.m. when something's happened. And I don't want you to think, oh, don't bother Miffy, because that's actually what this centre is here for, is for life and death things. The other thing, also preparing for our own death, that when we're sick or even when we're ill or tired, often we'll run away from the Dharma. We'll go, oh, I'm too tired for that. I'm too sick to come to medicine Buddha Puja or something like that. So actually that's when we're in extremis, that's when we should run towards the Dharma. That's when we've got to ask for help. But I know psychologically many of us go, oh, I don't want to be any bother. And that's exactly the wrong time to have that thought, because for life and death things. So I'm really pleased when people ring me up at 3 a.m. saying, my dog is dying, what do I do? And they're really embarrassed because they've been coming to Lungri Tumba Centre for like 5 years and they think that they should know. But I'm thrilled that they ring me, because it, you just need someone else to be able to talk to about this, to be able to regain your equilibrium and then be able to help whoever's there.
This is the coolest thing.
So, yes, this is the coolest thing. I've got mine, my What to Do with the Dead Buddhist card in my wallet next to my my blood group card. So that, you know, if I'm hit by a bus, they'll whip it out. They'll see the blood group and they'll go, huh, what's this? But they'll see a phone number.
But it's yours.
It is. It is mine. Well, it can't be anybody. There's the Lungri Tapa Centre phone number too. But you see, no one hardly answers that phone number. It goes to the, so the, I used to answer the Lungri Tapa Centre phone when it rang at 3 a.m. It just turned out to be crank calls from America. But anyway, so how to help a dying person. Keep calm. We're here to help. There are some kind of ways that we can help, even if we don't feel that we're ready. And the main thing is to help the dying person keep a happy, contented mind. Help them whatever way it is. So one of them is to for us to relax. And remember that talking about death won't bring it on. It's not like a superstitious thing that we can't talk about it because it might hasten it. We've got to be strong and keep fighting the disease or whatever. If they want to talk about death, then don't go, oh, shut up. Let's not talk about that. Let's just think about fighting this disease, la, la, la. If they want to talk about it, relax and let them talk about it. Because actually talking about death demystifies it. It makes it less terrifying, not more. It won't bring it on. We don't have to worry. When someone is nearing the end of death, help them arrange all their worldly affairs. Help them enjoy giving their things away. Ask them if there's anything, you know, anything outstanding, including help them resolve grudges. If there's been long family disputes or anything like that, help them resolve those things. And if there's anything preying on the person's mind, to help them confess and purify. So whether they're Buddhist, whether they're Christian, whether they're no religion whatsoever, everyone has this urge to confess and purify. So nurses that work in the hospital have told me oftentimes they're the one. They're holding the hand of the person who's dying and they basically get like a last confession from the person because they just need to tell somebody. So we can help them do that. And then if they have a religion, then whatever their religion is, help them reconnect with it. So if they're Christian, you help them confess and purify in a Christian manner. If they're Buddhist, you help them do it in a Buddhist manner. If they have no religion whatsoever, then you ask them, what are they comfortable with? And just have it as a conversation. But the Buddhist way of talking about confession is laying down the burden. And that's really what it is. It allows you to lay down that burden and release it. The last thing we want to do is hold them back and go, please don't die, please don't die. Like if it's happening, then it's our job to act calm and confident and say, it's going to be okay. And encourage them in their refuge. So it doesn't, no kind of converting people to Buddhism at the end, doesn't matter. It's whatever their refuge is. And I found even for people that are not religious at all, playing some kind of really nice classical music, so music that doesn't have words in it or that's really calming, can help the mind become calm. And also inspiring poetry. So many people who are materialists still have some form of poetry that's moved them. So something that is bigger and better than us, any form of refuge like that. And try and keep a calm environment. So everything calm and still. And part of the things of what we can do and they can do is rejoicing in all of their qualities. So many times, especially if there's relatives around, everyone feels really useless and we get this urge, I've got to do something. Because the more powerless and out of control we feel, that's what we want to do. We just got to do something, anything. So the thing to do is to rejoice. And this is a natural thing that people have, like in wakes and things like that, isn't it? You talk about the good things that that person did or the funny things that happened. So when you're in the waiting room and you, instead of stressing and worrying, which will emanate out to everybody, including the dying person, this is the time to bring all of our discipline in and think about all their good qualities and tell them about their good qualities. And even if they didn't have any good qualities, to tell them that they have, you know, a pristine, clear nature and everything's going to turn out okay and you were loved and you did the best that you could and look at all the benefit that you brought. Even if they're an asshole, doesn't matter. Now's the time to actually bring all of that, those qualities to the fore. It's really important. It's important because it strengthens those qualities and it turns the mind in that positive direction, positive momentum. Then allowing the turning off all of the apparatus that keeps us artificially alive. So turning off invasive drips, not fussing. So if you're in palliative care, that's very easy, that happens. But if you're in a hospital, ironically, because everything's geared to keep you alive, it's very difficult to die peacefully in a hospital. And if you can, to sing mantras out loud, but not in a panicked way, in a nice, beautiful, calm way. So I've noticed this when someone's pet's been dying and they've said, oh, yeah, I've been saying the mantras. So there's a mantra on here on the bottom, the Medicine Buddha mantra. They say, I've been going, Tai Tai, oh, I'm like, no. This is how you do it. You're just sitting in the hospital, there's other people around, and you just hum, like, Tai Tai, Om, beckons air, Ma beckons air, beckons air, Radza Samugati Swaha. Tayata on beckons air, beckons air. Maha beckons air, beckons air, Radza Samugati Swaha. Everyone will just think you're humming. The nurses will think, oh, that's nice. Everyone will be blessed, and it helps the consciousness of that person, and it helps you, because if you are singing calm and beautiful and soft and quiet, it'll help still your mind, and then you'll be much more useful for them. So even when my mother was dying at home, and so she had brain tumors, and so she was having, what are they, like little mini strokes or kind of seizures. And so one of the her students, Western monk, came in and was just holding her hand and saying, it'll be okay, it'll be all right. And she was very agitated. And he was just saying, it'll be okay, it'll be all right, over and over again, which is a bit inane. And then Eddie, thank you, Eddie, just went, oh, this is ridiculous. And he came in and he took his hand away, held her hand and started singing mantras slowly and nicely. And immediately her seizure stopped. So this is kind of what happens. We just get into this panic and we just say, it'll be okay, don't worry, it'll be okay. Inanities come out of our mouth. So if we're going to say anything, have the power of the mantras behind it. And these mantras, they don't rely on belief. They affect animals just as they affect humans. Animals have no belief in mantras, but I've seen again and again, once you start chanting the mantras, they completely calm down. So we have these things available to us that we can use. So the last bit about what to do with a dead Buddhist. And, Bruce, there's also this handout too. I forgot to give it to you. Liam, great. So everyone can have this. So this is just gives you a bit of an idea. It is in the the notes, if you got the notes as the package, but I want everybody to have this anyway. If you do come across someone who's died, you know, like Eileen, who just died this week at home, you know, you find them there on the floor or in bed, or the first thing is to check. Yeah, get two. Check whether they are actually alive or dead. That's the first thing. Because especially with suicide, someone may have only just tried to kill themselves, just hung themselves, or just taken the pills, and it is possible to save them. So we've got to check, absolutely, is it possible to save them? And then, but if, you know, clearly they've been lying there dead for quite a while, then the next thing is to stop. Sit down and breathe and give yourself some mental space. Even if you just come home, you could have come on the later bus, you know, so even just a few moments, rather than panic to have to do something, actually stop. And look around you, and you can identify whatever emotions are coming up, whatever's happened, what the room looks like, and you can even say to the dead body right there, oh, look, you know, I've come home and I've found you dead. Because it helps, as you describe it, it helps you become much more grounded into the situation. And then call Langri Tapa Centre. Call Langri Tapa Centre before you call an ambulance. Because once you call an ambulance, then the whole machinery of this starts happening. Whereas if you call Langri Tapa Centre in your panic first, we'll be able to say, where are you? What's happened? Have you checked? Have they just died? Is the body still warm or is it cold? All of these things, we'll be able to help you. So our one of our dear members, Maureen, you know, she came home from work and her husband Gunter had died. So he was there on the floor, and she panicked. She rang an ambulance. She knew he was dead. He'd been lying there for like 8-10 hours, but she rang an ambulance. So once you ring the ambulance come. Then because he was quite young, the police come, the detectives came, and then she rang us, and she rang us. The first I heard was she said, oh, hello, Miffy, are you busy? I'm like, yeah, we're just about to start class. She said, oh, I don't want to be any bother, but, you know, I've come home and Gunter's dead. I'm like, this isn't a bother. This is what we're here for. So then we actually went out there, but by the time we got there, this tiny, tiny little house, there was her, there was dead Gunter, there was the two detectives, there was the two ambulance people, and they're all going, well, come on, you know, we've got to hurry up. And what we're supposed to do is leave the body there to go through its whole process. So I just got my best stubborn weirdness on and took out my Buddhist things and started doing the medicine Buddha puja right there with Gunter with my back to the door. And Christine, who'd driven me there, Christina, was just like saying to the ambulance guys, she'll only be 10 minutes, she'll only be a minute. And they're going, well, hurry up, hurry up. And I'm like, not listening, not listening. We're doing this thing for Gunter. But it was quite tricky. It was. And it was very squishy as well. It was a very small house. And so what was clear was that the consciousness had not left the body. It was like Gunter was still there, but in a very rarefied way, not like a person chatty, but a presence. So then, luckily, because it was a Friday night, even though they did take the body fairly quickly, it went off to the morgue for the weekend, so relatively undisturbed. So that's a good thing. But because of that, that's Maureen was so shocked that she called the ambulance first and not us. Even though she'd been coming to the Langri Tapa Centre for 15 years. And not only that, but she forgot all of her mantras, because you go into shock, you forget. So that's why I've written the medicine Buddha one on the back, because that'll happen. And also if you ring us up, then we can say those mantras and it'll all come flooding back. You know, you'll get out of that being in shock. So that's why I said call Langri Tapa Centre first. Leave the body undisturbed. Many people die in the bathroom or on the toilet, so it looks a bit uncomfortable or a bit embarrassing, but don't worry, it's okay. Just leave the body as it is because they're not feeling anything, and it's better also for the police or whatever. Say the prayers or the mantras. Touch the body with holy objects if you have a stupa or a statue or the scriptures, and also these 10 great mantras. So they're written very, very small in Tibetan on the back of this card. So keep the card somewhere kind of in a nice place in your wallet. These are the 10 great mantras that you can just touch the area of the body. So the crown, the brow, the throat, the heart. So it doesn't have to physically touch the skin as such. It can be just in the area. But this can also be for when you find a dead animal on the side of the road. You can laminate this card and touch the body. If the person's at home, you can leave a Dharma text or a statue or something at the crown of their head. Place a stupa on the crown. Oh, leave the body undisturbed. That must have been an important point because I put it there twice. And then before moving the body, and so before Gunter was taken away in the body bag, you pull the hair at the crown so that the last physical and energy experience is there at the crown. So you can get the lock of hair at the crown and yank quite hard. Now, Gunter was bald as a cannonball, so in that case, we just tapped his head with the stupa quite hard there. So that's so that the consciousness, the subtle consciousness, is drawn to that place and exits through the crown. And then call the ambulance when you're ready. And so if in doubt, just wait. Just wait even just a moment to gather yourself so that you're not being reactive, but you know now is the time to call. And actually, if you manage to die leisurely at home or go through the death process at home, you just need a doctor to be able to come and certify that you're dead. So with Inta, my mother, when she died, Dr. Leo came when her breath stopped and certified that the breath has stopped, and then you're able to leave the body there. So we left the body in the house for like 2.5 days until the consciousness left the body. And for that whole time, you know, there was no bad smell, there was no decomposition, nothing, because the body and mind were still connected. And then when the consciousness left the body, one of the signs is a bit of blood comes out from the mouth or the nose. And so that happened after 2.5 days. And the room just started to smell a little bit stale. Not badly, just a bit like, oh, perhaps you should change the sheets or something. And suddenly her body looked like a shell, finished. So that was just as clear as day to me. So then once the consciousness is left, once the body is gone, then you can relax and cry. Up until then, our job is to help that consciousness. This is And when my mother was dying, I was thinking she brought me into this world. My job is to help her out of this world in as best a possible way as can be. So it's really possible to do. Then, you know, once all of that's finished, then you can collapse, have a cup of tea, cry, everyone, you know, what is it? Console you, all of those things. So we've got how to contemplate death now while we're alive, the 9-point death contemplation, and this helps us live without fear and regret. Then we've got becoming familiar with the actual process of dying so that when it happens, we can recognize it and we don't freak out. We know it, just like we know how to get to Lungri Tumpa Center. We know where we're going and what's going to happen, instead of being all discombobulated. And helping others through death is the biggest service you can do for another human being. It is the most profound thing you can do for another human being. And we can, even though we may not feel ready, we can really help just by developing this attitude and having a little bit of background like this to hold on to, like a lifesaver. So I certainly wasn't ready when my mother was dying, but because she was a really amazing Buddhist and was really curious about what was going to happen, and because she died leisurely at home, it was a really good death. So it gave me a huge amount of confidence. And now we have all sorts of amazing nuns here that can also help, that work in palliative care, that have a whole range of background experience to draw on. So I'm sure if you put the What to Do with a Dead Buddhist card on your fridge, you will be able to have that conversation with your family. It's probably a good way to start it. A lot of our members have this, and they've talked to their grown-up daughters and sons about, you know, what to do. And they roll their eyes and they know, oh, yeah, ring Miffy. So before we dedicate, any outstanding? Yes, Bruce. No, I think the inkling that you get before dying would be those first four visions of especially the mirage and the smoke. Yes, because once you go into those four appearances, that's already irreversible. But those ones, like I remember with Inta, was maybe up until a year before she died that she had the visions both of the mirage and then the smoke for like 3 or 4 weeks before she died, and even the little fireflies too. So it would waver in and out. But she did have a very leisurely death. So... with yes, the light at the end of the tunnel, I think that's right on the, just like the experience is, you make the decision to come back or not. So I think that's much more like that white increased vision. And if you go towards the light and keep on going, then the death process continues on. No, well, what happens after death, the intermediate state, where it's a much more subtle body and mind. And generally you take on the form of what your next rebirth is going to be, and you're kind of pushed around by karma and affliction and whatever virtue that you have, all propels you towards the next life till you find the circumstances, parents having sex and you are conceived, or into the egg or wherever it is that you're reborn. So in that intermediate state, they say there are a lot of visions that can happen, but it's kind of like if you've ever been delirious with the flu or delirious with alcohol, you know, there's visions and things that happen, and it's very willy-nilly, and what you end up doing in that state can have quite huge consequences, even though it's just all this craziness in your mind. But all it takes is one person to say, well, I know in my case, take my hand and go, hey, Miffy, get it together, come and sit down. And the, oh, all right, whatever. So then if we have a refuge, if we have someone guiding us and helping us, that can help all of those visions not have such a huge hold on us. And the refuge is like, really, it's got to be a heartfelt refuge. Just like our refuge is when things go wrong, we go, oh God, or oh Mum, you know, a real deep refuge. Yep. So they say the bardo state cannot be longer than 49 days, but doesn't mean we stay in it for 49 days. You could be reborn straight away. You could find the circumstances, the right, you know, be propelled into the next life straight away, or it could take a little longer. You could be wandering around trying to get in. Well, the human population's growing, but there's a whole lot of species going extinct as well. So where we end up is going to depend. It could be a human, but it could be a crocodile, depending on our preoccupation. It could be an eagle. It could be a long life god. Whatever our state of mind at the time of death is going to have a huge effect on where we end up next. And that's why it's so important to prepare for our death and be able to die peacefully, be practiced at it. And also to help the person who's dying be peaceful, even if they've had a messy life. So I know I've just gone a little bit over time, but my ex-husband, Jonathan, when he died, he had a weird, wonderful, extraordinary life. He was a complete alcoholic. He was an ecky head. He was everything. And he had an epiphany in the hospital and did Vajrasattva meditation for an entire night. He said he was bathed in light from Vajrasattva, and he had a really good death. So, you know, even someone like him, and it's because he was so good-hearted, even though his life was messy, I tell you what. I mean, all the ex-wives were there at the funeral. All the ex-mistresses and girlfriends were there at the funeral. Everybody was happy except the current wife, you know. So there was all this stuff happening, but he had a really, really good death. So we'll do the dedication, then I'll tell you what's happening next week. So let's dedicate that by contemplating death, we may live a really good life, take the essence of this life. May we ourselves have a peaceful death and be able to use that to develop realizations, to be able to benefit others. May we be the ones to help our family at death time, our pets at death time. May we be able to offer them this most precious, important service. And also please dedicate for Eileen Jabolt, who died this week, and for Jeff Christoffel, who's in the death process as we speak, both to Lungri Tampa Centre members. So during the week, do your will. I'll be checking on you. At least make the appointment. Put it in writing. It's really, really important. And have the talk with your family. So see if they notice this on the fridge. And if not, you may have to hurry it along a bit. And next week we're looking at bodhicitta. So the biggest attitude for the best result. It includes how to be compassionate and caring even towards people you don't like, even through the deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called them, how to actually care for everybody with genuine care and concern. And that's based on developing equanimity.